My Classic Album with Mike Norris is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of My Classic Album and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.
Hello everyone, and welcome to My Classic Album, the show that looks back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris, and this is Season 2 of My Classic Album. So anyone new to the podcast, there are 20 previous episodes that make up Season 1, covering fantastic albums from the likes of the Beatles, Queen, Radiohead, The Smiths, The Rolling Stones, and many more. All chosen by fantastic singers, songwriters, guitarists, musicians, music professionals who love those albums dearly. And that is kind of the hook of My Classic Album, if you like, that I'm not choosing the albums. These are chosen by my guests, who for them, these albums are, they're everything. They're, you know, the reason that they got into music or the reason that they love music as much as they do. And today is no exception. I have a fantastic guest to kick off Season 2 of My Classic Album. Former lead singer of Iron Maiden, Blaze Bayley, will be here in just a little bit talking about his chosen classic album. And that album is the debut release from heavy metal legends Dio, Holy Diver. So if you're into Ronnie James Dio and if you're into Iron Maiden, this is the show for you. I had such an awesome time chatting with Blaze, and I hope that comes across when you listen to the interview. And it was just a really cool opportunity to speak to someone who has such a deep passion for the album that they're talking about. And as I said before, that's the hook of this podcast, that all the people we talk to, they're talking about an album that they absolutely love, an album that perhaps inspired them to get into music, an album that's changed their life. And in the case of Blaze Bayley, as you'll hear, I was shocked at just how much Holy Diver has had such a huge impact on his life. And he even says at some point in the interview that there would be no Blaze Bayley as we know him today without Ronnie James Dio and without the Holy Diver album. And that interview is coming up in just a little bit. Absolutely must listen to if you're a fan of Blaze and indeed a fan of Dio. And we've got plenty more awesome guests and awesome albums coming up over the next few months, old friends and new. We've got some people who've appeared on the podcast previously returning to talk about yet another classic album that they enjoy, and some other fantastic singers, songwriters, musicians who want to get on the My Classic Album train and talk about an album that means so much to them. So if you like the sound of the podcast, you know, if you're new to this and you're thinking, yeah, already I'm digging this and I haven't even heard the interview yet, get yourself to www.myclassicalbum.co.uk, where you can listen to all of our previous episodes. Get yourself on Facebook, look for My Classic Album with Mike Norris, like the page. That's where you're going to find out first all the big guests that are coming on the show and all the albums we're going to be talking about. And I like to kind of share kind of what's going on with me, what music I'm listening to, all that sort of stuff as well. If you've got Instagram, My Classic Album Podcast. And again, I try to share stuff there as much as I can. Or you can follow me on Twitter, where I tend to post maybe once a month if you're lucky, at @MCA_podcast. I've been saying this for months, I must get better at Twitter. But Facebook and Instagram are the places to be if you want to know the latest goings on with My Classic Album. And as I say, we've got old friends and new over the next few months, so stay tuned to those social media channels, stay tuned to the podcast, and we'll keep you right. We'll let you know what's coming up over the next few months, and we've got some really cool albums that I think more than live up to the 20 albums, or 21, including Holy Diver, the 21 albums that we've covered so far. I think we might as well just get straight down to it. My guest today, lead singer of Wolfsbane, former lead singer of Iron Maiden, Blaze Bayley, and he has chosen one awesome album for his edition of My Classic Album, the debut effort from Dio, Holy Diver. But before we get to Blaze, and trust me, it is definitely worth waiting for this one, here's just the facts. Here's what you need to know about Holy Diver. Released on the 25th of May, 1983, Holy Diver is the debut studio album by American heavy metal band Dio. Self-produced by lead singer Ronnie James Dio, the album was recorded at Sound City Studios in California and was distributed by Warner Brothers in North America and Vertigo in the UK. As a result of disagreements during the mixing of Black Sabbath's live album Live Evil, Dio and drummer Vinnie Appice abruptly left the band and quickly set to work forming the band that would become Dio. Former Rainbow bass player Jimmy Bain and Sweet Savage guitarist Vivian Campbell, who would go on to play with Def Leppard, completed the lineup, and work began at Sound City Studios on their debut album. Thanks to Ronnie's time in bands like Elf, Rainbow and Black Sabbath, the Holy Diver album already had a tailor-made audience upon its release. The album hit number 56 on the US Billboard 200, while reaching number 13 in the UK album charts. Title track and lead single Holy Diver only reached number 72 on the UK singles charts, but reached number 40 in the mainstream rock charts in the USA. However, it was Rainbow in the Dark, with its memorable keyboard motif, that contributed strongly to the album's success, reaching number 14 on the mainstream rock charts in the US, and helping the album to achieve platinum status in 1989. The album was critically praised from its release right through to present day, and is seen as an important hallmark in the history of heavy metal. Loudwire named Holy Diver the 6th best debut metal album of all time in 2013. WhatCulture.com named it one of the 10 greatest metal albums of the 1980s in 2017, and that same year, Rolling Stone named it 16th on its 100 greatest metal albums of all time. So that's just the beginning of what we need to know about Holy Diver, and I have here with me my special guest who chose the album. This is Blaze Bailey. How's it going?
Hello, it's going very, very well. I'm on a short break. It's nice to be at home for a few days because it's been a very, very busy year.
So let's start us off. Why have you chosen Holy Diver to talk about on my classic album here today?
Well, it's perhaps the single most influential album on my career in music since I started. I didn't really know much about Ronnie James Dio, and I was working in a hotel at the time. I was 18, and I worked doing the night shift a lot of the time as a night porter in a hotel, so I listened to a lot of different music. A friend of mine used to give me tapes, and he'd got quite an interesting rock taste. And the first time I heard Ronnie James Dio's voice was with Rainbow. And I thought it was very, very interesting. And I suppose there's just something about the man's voice that sticks with you, you know. The register of his voice, the sound of it, the way he pronounces things, and he'll make anything sound convincing. And that kind of led me on a path to find out about Ronnie James Dio. And I went to see Ronnie Dio on his Holy Diver tour. He was in Birmingham. Birmingham Odeon. They've converted it back to a proper multi-screen cinema now. It's not a gig anymore. I heard Ronnie James Dio sing Children of the Sea from his Black Sabbath days. Seeing him singing that live and hearing that live, it was an epiphany, really. And that's what made me decide that I wanted to be a singer and a rock singer and tour the world. I wanted to be able to do what Ronnie James Dio did. And it was just a little while after that that I got the Holy Diver album, after I'd seen that Holy Diver tour. And I got it on the vinyl, and I was still living at home at the time. So with the headphones, I would kind of co-opt the turntable and listen to that album again and again and again and again on headphones, and did a tape of it and listened to it on my night shift at work as well, until it just became a part of me, really. And it said everything to me about power and commitment. And in some way, even though many of the lyrics are some of them a bit mystical, then it still gave me a sense of truth. And the sound of Ronnie James Dio's voice, and it just stayed with me for years and years as my go-to album in crisis. And if something was wrong, if you're going through a big funk in my life, split up with a girlfriend, Holy Diver. If something goes right and you want to feel like partying and picking yourself up, come on, let's go for it, Holy Diver. And over the years, as you know, I've been very, very lucky in my life to actually achieve that dream of becoming a professional singer, then I've been places and heard Stand Up and Shout or Gypsy, or of course, Don't Talk to Strangers. And I've been somewhere in some rock pub or at a gig, and somebody's put that on over the PA, and it's always snapped me right back, as our favourite albums do, to that time in my life when I believed I could accomplish anything, because why wouldn't you be able to, if, you know, just learn and work hard and accomplish your dream. And I've been very, very lucky in my life that I have accomplished my dream, and I'm actually living my dream right now. And a huge part of that is Holy Diver and Ronnie James Dio and the influence that he had on me. And when I made my very first album with Wolfsbane in Los Angeles in the very famous Sound City Studios, we were in a rehearsal room just across the car park from the Sound City Studios. And I went over there to get some coffee, and Ronnie James Dio was there, and he was producing a demo for a local band. Well, in LA, a local band, you know, they could be fairly successful, can't they? And I was as nervous as hell, because by this time I owned everything that I could get of Ronnie James Dio from his L days right through Holy Diver, everything that he'd done. I had it all on vinyl by that time. I was a huge Ronnie James Dio fan. I wasn't scared to meet anybody. But when I saw him come out of the control room at Sound City, I was bricking it, man. He was such a gracious and courteous person. And people say, never meet your heroes. And I would say, if your heroes are arseholes, it's not worth meeting them. And if you're drunk, don't meet your heroes, because you're going to be the arsehole. So those are the caveats I put on that one. And I met him, and he was very gracious, and we talked about music. And he can't have known that I knew all of his early work from Elf. So I was kind of dropping a couple of questions in to kind of find out a little bit more, a little bit of probing without being too obvious, and say, hey, Ronnie, I love you to bits. Give me a hug. I was saying, oh, and when you were with Elf, did you do much touring? And he told me this amazing story. He said, man, Elf, we were one of the loudest bands on the circuit right then. And we took with us a big PA everywhere we went. And sometimes the venue owner would say, you can't have it that loud. We cannot have the gig that loud. And you know what we did? We just packed all our equipment into the truck and went to the next gig. So my hero is actually my hero. So it's absolutely fantastic, man. It was incredible. And over the years, I was very lucky to bump into him a few times. And when I was in Iron Maiden doing the Virtual 11 tour, I think it was, then Ronnie James Dio, God of rock vocals himself, was supporting Maiden with me singing in Maiden. And that was very, very daunting. You know, I never really compared myself to Bruce Dickinson. He's got an amazing, wonderful voice, but he approaches things, you know, from a different way. He's a wonderful guy who's given me a lot of support over the years. But I never really felt intimidated by the ghost of Bruce or filling those shoes. And Bruce was always very positive towards me about being the singer of Iron Maiden. But being in Iron Maiden and going on after Ronnie James Dio, that was the big one, man. That was absolutely scary. But also, of course, inspirational. And I would go out whenever I could. I would be out there in the audience watching Ronnie and meet fans. And we'd be talking about Ronnie and what he was doing and stuff like that. And it was incredible. And I remember one time that we were in Phoenix, Arizona, and it was one of the smallest gigs on the tour. At that time, a lot of big changes in the music business. There was no theatre, no real theatre-sized venue to play. And the only other venue that was available in Phoenix was a stadium, and there was no way that Maiden with me at that time on Virtual 11, there's no way you could play a stadium. We ended up, the only gig that we could do was this really, really small, in the round local theatre, which even only had 500 people in there. And it's impossible to think of Iron Maiden playing to only 500 people, but that's what it was. And Ronnie had just gone on and done his set. And I walked on the stage and it was in the round. So there was no backdrops. And what the crew had done, they'd done this great job. They propped up Eddie behind the drums. So there was no backdrop. You couldn't fit any production whatsoever. And man, it was just incredible. It was a very difficult day for me. And I watched Ronnie on that stage doing his thing in that place. And as a complete and utter professional, he just went on and he did it as if it was, you know, the 50,000 people. And that was just an inspiration. I went on after that and I thought, well, man, my hero has just gone and shown what you have to do no matter what the gig is. And it was just one of my favourite ever gigs that I've done with Iron Maiden because there was no barrier. You could actually go and touch the crowd. So I jumped into the audience with the mic and started singing The Trooper with the guys in the crowd. It was awesome. It was absolutely fantastic. Fantastic gig. And I even wrote a song about that gig on one of my albums. It's a bonus song on my Silicon Messiah album. And it's called Motherfuckers Are Us. It's a memory of that day, and a huge part of that, of course, is the fact that I went on after God of Rock Vocals, the ultimate hero, Ronnie James Dio, and it was just incredible. And of course, on that tour, he was playing a couple of tracks. He always played Holy Diver, and I think he did Don't Talk to Strangers on that, and Stand Up and Shout, I think he did on that tour. So it was a fantastic experience. And many years later at Wacken, then I was able to be on stage, on the side of the stage, while Ronnie was actually performing at Wacken in the late afternoon. That was absolutely incredible. And when he came back to Birmingham, then because I knew him a little bit by that time, then invited me backstage, and I actually had a glass of wine with him and his wife backstage in Birmingham. I think the Hummingbird, I think the venue is called down there. So an incredible, incredible influence that the man and the album had on my life. And I could say probably there just would not be a Blaze Bayley as you know it if it hadn't been for the influence of Ronnie James Dio and Holy Diver and that tour and that album.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've talked so much about Ronnie James Dio and the impact he's had, well, not just on your life, but so many lives, I guess. If we look at kind of the band Dio as it was at that point, it started out with Ronnie and Vinny Appice on drums. They were the kind of the first two members. How important is Vinny in establishing the sound on Holy Diver and indeed those early Dio albums?
Absolutely vital to the sound. And it has been an influence on my own sound in that now, many years later, you know, I've been in the music business for over 30 years now, and now I actually produce my own albums. And when I talk to Martin McNee, who is the drummer that I use on all of my work now, he comes into the studio, does a great job for me. And when I rehearse with Martin, then I'm always looking to find these big fills and looking for the space and the time to allow these big toms to reveal themselves and put them into the right place. As many times as I can, get these big fills out. Now, that very first day when I met Ronnie James Dio, Vinny Appice was actually in the studio doing the drums for the band, doing the demo drums for the band. They hired him to do the drums, so it's incredible. And his groove and the things that he's done are just great. I always think about what he's done and how musical really that he is, and really an old school in the truest sense of the school he went to must have been old, and he plays like he's from an old school. Yeah, it's been a big influential sound. And one of the things, when that Holy Diver album came out and he was doing those drums, there just was not the reliance on effects and the sampling that we have now. Everything was recorded analog. It was before the first hard discs were invented. People were doing things on 2-inch 24-track tape, and you were getting the true and real sound of a well-tuned, well-played drum kit, and you could really tell how good that drummer was. It's a huge part of it.
Yeah, so Ronnie and Vinny began to form these songs together in a small shack behind Ronnie's house, Vinny on drums and Ronnie on bass, while they looked for a guitarist. And from what I can gather, Ronnie was insistent that he wanted a British guitarist. And I've got a quote here from an interview that's on the deluxe edition of Holy Diver. Dio says, "I really wanted an English player. I love the way they play, take chances, what they do on stage. The attitude of the British musician, to me, is just far superior." So surely having played with guitar legends such as Tony Iommi and Black Sabbath, Richie Blackmore and Rainbow, that has to have been a major influence in that decision to want a British player for Dio.
Yeah, I think so. You know, there's a lot of, obviously, incredible music on both sides of the Atlantic and the US and Britain are about equal, but in different things, you know, and I think some of the some of the rawness, and for want of a better word, I know it sounds very cheesy, the soul that you'll find is with those English players. I'm very, very lucky that I've worked with some of the top guitarists in the world, you know, and some fantastic players who, you know, weren't recognised, but I recognised as good. The guitarist that I work with right now in my band, Chris Appleton, there's just something that when you ask him, can I have, I need this with just a bit more to it. There's something that when Chris Appleton relaxes, there's something that happens with the way that he plays that guitar that just starts moving people and just starts connecting with people. And I can only say that that's something that must be in the water or from the, you know, from Britain, going right back to Rory Gallagher, Gary Moore, and players like this. Dave Murray is just standing in a rehearsal room with Dave Murray and hearing him play in the rehearsal room is awesome. In the truest sense of the word, after you've seen the man on big stages, you know, I've seen Maiden many times before I joined Maiden. And to stand there and hear some of those solos and melodies and be in the room and see the man's hands moving, it's just incredible. So precise, but so much feeling to every single note that's played. Nothing is thrown away. And Dave Murray is an incredible, incredible guitarist. And I think it must have been working and seeing these things. When I spoke to Ronnie many times, we'd always talk about Birmingham and the Elbow Room and people that we both knew from Birmingham, and they're slightly different eras, but there were one or two people that we both knew, and he liked to have English crew as well. So I think that time in England that he spent when he was working with Sabbath, I think that was just such a huge influence when he was, you know, he was around Birmingham working on Heaven and Hell and Mob Rules.
So Dio called upon former Rainbow bandmate Jimmy Bain to see if he knew any guitarists that would fit the bill. Bain recommended Sweet Savage guitarist Vivian Campbell, who of course would go on to play with Def Leppard. The four met at a rehearsal studio in London, and the rest is history. How do you think Vivian Campbell's style complements Dio's vocals in comparison to the likes of Iommi and Blackmore, who Dio had worked with previously?
Well, I think it's very enthusiastic, brash in places. There's a lot of energy to it. It really feels like, for me, on the Holy Diver album, that Vivian Campbell, it's like, wow, this guy has just broken out of prison and he's done it using a guitar and now he's on the run. And that's the kind of feeling, you know, where you need melody, then he seems to just find it and know where it is on that album. There's flashy things, of course, but also he's not scared to play a melody in places and not scared to just dig in and play the riff precise and really feel that beat. Really feel it and dig the riff right into it and get those downstrokes in the right place. And that's what makes the difference when he's doing things, plucking on the downstrokes and then doubling up and doing these really fast things and the changes that he's doing, some quite simple ones in the chords, that's what makes the difference to his playing on that album, you know. And I'd love to have been a fly on the wall in the studio around the times that they were doing those rehearsals and making that album and see what they talked about and the kind of coaching, I imagine, that Ronnie gave Vivian Campbell.
Yeah, and it's funny because Dio claimed that Jimmy Bain had actually misinterpreted that initial phone call and that there wasn't initially a place in the band for him. He says Jimmy took it on himself to bring his bass and kind of made the assumption he was in too. But in Jimmy's words, when the four got together in that London rehearsal space, it was fucking magic. Which kind of brings together everything we've been talking about, that Dio is far from a vanity solo project at this point. It's the sum of four very talented musicians, and I think we've kind of touched on that really well.
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, it kind of makes sense. When we had our Wolfsbane reunion many years after Maiden, you know, I started my solo project and established myself as Blaze Bailey, the solo artist. And we wanted to kind of have a get together, have a Wolfsbane reunion. And we didn't know what to expect. We hadn't all been in the same room together for a long time. And we went into that rehearsal room and we kind of didn't know what we had. And there was just a magic there. And it was really, it was as if we were the same people that we were 17 years earlier, with the same feelings. And there was just some kind of, you know, they call it a bit cheesy, black wind in that room when we did that Wolfsbane rehearsal. And when we started jamming a few new songs, it was just like the old days. So I think there is this musical telepathy that when you get certain people in a room together, that group of people will make a certain sound, and that is unique to them. And it would make sense to me that, right, and with the accidents as well, there has to be a serendipity about misinterpreting a phone call or a deliberate misinterpretation to someone who thinks, hang on, there's a really good gig going here. I'm just going to pretend I've already got it. there has to be an element of that. There just is. There is no real planning that you can do to have heart and soul in your band. So much of what I've done in the last 3 years with my album, I feel like a lot of it is just a bunch of accidents. And by accident, I've ended up with something really, really good. But I tried to do something really good, but I never knew how I would get there. And I think when they got together in that rehearsal room and whatever was going on around them, then there was an attitude between them and a look, and that translated into the sound. And I bet some of those songs were very quick to write.
Yeah, and I guess from what I've read, I think that's very true that a lot of them were. There's been some dispute over the years around the name of the band, and obviously Dio was a long way from being decided when the band started recording the album at Sound City, as he had said. While both Ronnie and Wendy have said it was merely a business decision designed to sell the album, Jimmy Bain once said, "I thought it was a shit name. I'd rather have been called The Carpets than Dio." Do you think that Dio was a good name for the band? Do you think it was the most sensible name for the band?
As a business thing, you can't fault it as a decision. You know, I don't know whether it's the best name for a band. I just don't know. But I've been in that same situation, and you're like, well, there is a name here that I've worked on and I've established myself over years of sweat, blood, tears and disappointments. And all I really have is this name. And all it's really good for is to tell people that they might like this kind of music. And without this name, I've got to go right back down, not to the bottom of the ladder, but I've got to join the queue of the people that want to hold the ladder. So without using those little bits that you've worked for, you're back to square one. And that is such a difficult place to be. In reality, you have to use everything that you've got to make people take notice of you. That's what promotion is. People spend millions on promotion and making a name for themselves. If you've got a little bit of a name already, that's what you have to use. That is just good common sense in business. It's lovely and romantic to think that it could have been something else. But David Coverdale did this amazing thing with Whitesnake, but I'm not sure that could have been replicated.
Yeah, so regardless of any band politics or anything like that, Holy Diver became a huge success for Dio, and as we've discussed, it cemented itself as a true heavy metal classic. Loudwire identified the success of Quiet Riot's Metal Health as it reached number one in March 1983, just a few months before Holy Diver, as the beginning of this kind of mainstream success that metal would enjoy in the 80s. Do you think that Holy Diver benefited from that newfound love of metal from the mainstream?
Well, absolutely. You know, heavy metal was the most popular music in the world in the 80s, and we had vinyl, so we could really hear, you know, what was going on. Most of us that just had a turn, you didn't really need a great system. The better the system that you had, the more you heard, the more connected you could be. We had cassette tapes, and, you know, it was just before the advent of CDs and the killing of vinyl, the attempted murder of the vinyl format. I think, yeah, you know, then in those days, the bits of plastic, the vinyl and the cassettes, whatever else that we had, sold so much that actually meant that people could go on tour and they could subsidize their tour with their album sales. So you could have a bigger bus and a bigger show and more crew and more comfort on your tour than you were ever able to have, really, before the metal started and before the music business got to this incredible place where they could sell so many bits of plastic, so many items, that it would fund these huge, elaborate tours and long time in the studio, months in the studio, for some people years in the studio, because the people doing the numbers said, well, we sell enough bits of plastic, pieces of vinyl, cassette tapes, we'll make all this back if we put enough money into promotion.
Blaise Bailey there, talking with me about Holy Diver by Dio. And, you know, usually that first question, why have you picked this as your classic album today, is usually like a 2 or 3 minute answer. And this isn't an insult at all. Like, Blaise took a good, as you heard there, a good 15 minutes to answer that question. And the journey from, you know, him working in that hotel at night, listening to the album, to having Dio support him as he played with Iron Maiden, to me, that's just absolutely mind-blowing. And I thought, I need to share all that with you. I can't cut any of that out. That sort of thing is the reason why I started this podcast. And we're just getting started, because Blaise and I are about to go track by track, covering every song on the Holy Diver album. Coming up, which heavy metal band recorded Blaise's favourite cover version of Stand Up and Shout? And which track on Holy Diver nearly didn't make the cut, because Ronnie James Dio was going to cut the tape itself? All that and more right after this. Enjoying this episode of My Classic Album? Don't forget, there are loads of amazing albums covered in our previous episodes as part of Season 1, with guests including Guns N' Roses keyboardist Dizzy Reed.
If I had to pick one like favorite band, or I guess a band that was the biggest influence on me, I would go with the Rolling Stones.
Blues guitarist Big Boy Blotter.
It sounded great there and it sounded great now. It just seems to have stood the test of time with me anyway, so yeah, it's a real classic for me.
And Nathan Stevens Griffin of Martha.
It's a great song musically, you're absolutely right. It is, it's a banger. Mm-hmm. It is like absolutely a barnstormer of an album opener right there.
Also, there's our anniversary episodes, such as 40 Years of Rumours with Fleetwood Mac, including an interview with engineer Ken Kelly.
Within about 15 minutes, the band was fighting. I've seen, you know, Crosby, Stills and Nash fight, I've seen Kenny Loggins and Jim Messina fight, but This was a weird, I've never seen couples fight.
And 40 years of Bat Out of Hell, including an interview with the voice of Paradise by the Dashboard Light, Ellen Foley.
Time is sometimes tricky. Sometimes things seem like very long ago in another life, which it is, but it all, the memories of it and certainly the song itself is always sort of alive in my mind.
All these episodes and more are available at www.myclassicalbum.co.uk and on Podnos, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network.
So now seems a really cool time to go track by track. So we'll just kind of touch on each track on the album. And we'll start with our first track, Stand Up and Shout. It was thrown together, in the words of the band, during the Sound City sessions. Vivian Campbell says of the song, "That was a Jimmy riff. Although he and I go back and forth on this because it was similar to an old Sweet Savage thing, but that was stolen from a Gary Moore riff, so it was 6 degrees of separation. What are your thoughts on Stand Up and Shout, and is it a good opener for the album?"
Yeah, I think it is. It's kind of traditional, really. Or I don't know, maybe I'm modelled up that now it has become more traditional to open up a heavy metal, heavy rock album with a song like this, to kind of stake your claim, put your flag out there and say, "Hey, this is who we are. This is the 1-2. Here's the punch in the face. This is one. And a little next, we're going to get you in the belly." And I think Stand Up and Shout really is that bit of a punch in the face. It is an expression of excitement that you put on this album. And wow. And it's really fast, really fast riffing, and it's very, very exciting. And one of the great cliches of metal, when it is done well, is this repetitive, exciting riff. And Stand Up and Shout is a perfect example of how to do that well.
Yeah, and it's funny you should talk about that kind of 1-2 punch. Loudwire called Stand Up and Shout and our next track, Holy Diver, an effective 1-2 punch that proved Dio could rock as hard as ever. Do you think that maybe in his own mind, if nothing else, he felt like he had something to prove after his exile from Black Sabbath?
Well, I would have thought so, because he got the sack.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like, well, of course, he has become a legend now. And he will always he's in the stars, isn't he now? He's there, he is in the firmament of the heavy metal night sky. And we can never, ever forget him. But I think at that time, then he did feel that he had to show people that he was good enough, that he was worthy. He knew it. Because he'd written some of the greatest lyrics ever. He'd sang some of the greatest rock music that never be forgotten with Black Sabbath and with Rainbow. So he'd been up the top there. And now to start again, I think he did have something to prove. I think he had to prove anything to himself. I think he had to show people, because in the music business, they will doubt you, man. When you're cold, you're as cold as ice. And there is a saying, and it's horrible. It's absolutely vile. But there is a saying from those days, music business, hit records cure cancer. And it's the most vile and horrible thing. But that's what people used to say. And if you were out, you were out. And I think it's a huge part of Ronnie saying, well, yeah, you can count me out, but you don't know me.
And I mean, Stand Up and Shout, it's very much become an anthem for Dio, and one that's been covered by the likes of Fozzy and Adrenaline Mob. And it also became the name of a cancer fund set up in his name after his death. What is it about the song that's made it such an integral part of kind of the makeup of the legend of Ronnie James Dio? I mean, we've talked about what a great song it is.
If you listen to Fozzy, right, Chris Jericho loves music. He loves metal. He loves classic rock. He's a wonderful, wonderful singer in his own right. He has a fantastic character voice, you know, which is influenced by Ronnie. And when you listen to the Fozzy version of Stand Up and Shout, it is sung and performed with so much enthusiasm. And you can't get that enthusiasm for performing a song if it doesn't have some seed of integrity and dark passion in it. That's what I think when I listen to Stand Up and Shout and I listen to the covers. But the best cover up for me, the one that I like the best, is the Fozzy cover of Stand Up and Shout.
So we'll move on to Holy Diver, our title track, and one of two tracks credited exclusively to Ronnie James Dio. It's timeless and doom-laden, according to Ultimate Classic Rock, and like much of his work, it has a strong fantasy theme. Loudwire claimed that Dio's imaginative and narrative lyrics struck a chord with the fantasy and role-playing generation, which thrilled to the singer's references to dragons, magic, and mystery. As a young music fan listening to Dio for the first time on those night shifts, what was it like to plunge into this world of kind of tigers and dragons and fantasy?
Well, I think one of the things that happened to me was my late father was someone who was very interested in telepathy and psychology, and he could read tarot cards, and he was really good, and he was very sensitive. And I remember listening to Holy Diver and talking to my father about it, about what do you think this means, and having a conversation with him about that song and the lyrics of it. The way that he's done those lyrics, for me, one of the classic things, maybe I'm wrong, but it's a feeling, and it's a strong feeling that I have. No one else can ever write that lyric. No one else can get close to what that lyric expresses. And it's because the way that it fits into the rhythm of the song and the emphasis that he puts on the consonants and some of the vowels and the way he places tiger and midnight sea, the phrasing of those things, that brings a certain amount of life and integrity to the lyric that I believe no other singer that has been born and perhaps will be born can ever do. So it is not just the lyric. It is the man delivering and performing with conviction this incredible lyrical poetry that he has done. Words that live off the page, but they do not live without the melody and the rhythm. Whenever you say the words Holy Diver, you go, and well, I do, and everybody I know does, you fall into the rhythm of the song, and it starts happening to you. And it is an incredible, mystical, and magical feeling that this lyric and this melody and this incredible rhythm can move you without listening to the original recording.
And I've got an awesome quote from Dio talking about kind of the fantasy themes and in his lyrics. He said, "When I became a songwriter, I thought, what better thing to do than do what no one else is doing, to tell fantasy tales, smartest thing I ever did." And it's something that's so intrinsically him, just this kind of fantasy lyrics and the images that he conjures, as you say, with kind of the placement and the way that he says these things.
It's impossible as well. It is absolutely impossible. And I don't use that word lightly, because it is a word I completely and utterly reject many, many times when people say, oh, it's impossible. And they said to me over the years, you're never going to make it. You'll never be a singer. It's impossible. You can't get a record. Over the years, I heard it all. And I just said, well, it may be impossible for you. In this lyric, Holy Diver, I mean, who comes up with it? It's just impossible. It's something from another realm. It's impossible. The actual lyric that he's done, it's impossible to come up with. But people, geniuses like David Bowie and Freddie Mercury, have come up with incredible lyrics in this way. So that's where he ranks lyrically, in a very mystical place. I don't know what stars aligned. And did he write in starlight when he wrote the words to Holy Diver? I don't know, but I would like to think so. And then later on, he wrote the song about writing Holy Diver.
Mm. So Classic Rock magazine suggests that Holy Diver's anthemic beat was reminiscent of Survivor's Eye of the Tiger, which was a huge hit at the time. Have you made that connection before, and can you see any similarities there?
I never made that connection until you said
that. Neither did I.
So I think that's just one of the coincidences of rock. You know, you'll pick a groove and that's it. But it is really not an unusual groove. It's something which is one of those cliches, one of the staple grooves that we'll use in different parts of songs. We'll find that groove. So it's accessible to anybody. But what is, you use that as the platform, the foundation, then to build your song upon. So it's, for me, it's nothing to do with Eye of the Tiger, which is a great song in its own right, you know. But it's nothing to do with that. I don't draw that similarity. As a record producer, then I go, okay, well, here's one of the tools that we use. We establish a groove using this, and then this is a foundation. We have our lyric, and we have an idea of our melody and where we want to go, and this is where the idea starts. And then we have to be loyal to that idea and not steer that idea away from its own destiny and from itself and the appearance of what it should be in its own right without any of us being in the room.
So we'll move on to Gypsy, which is a more straightforward rocker compared to a track like Holy Diver. Ronnie once said that Gypsy was his attempt at something a little bit more like the Rolling Stones, and that it was important after a track like Holy Diver to have something a bit more feelful. Do you find that Rolling Stones comparison works? Is it a good one for Gypsy?
It's never struck me.
No.
At all, I think, and that's because Vivian Campbell is just, you know, miles and miles away from the Rolling Stones. You know, he may have a Rolling Stones influence there, but he certainly doesn't wear it on his sleeve. So I think for me, Gypsy is just a really good song. And something that is exactly in the right place on the album and does the job it needs to do.
So a metal blog, Nick's Metal Blog, singles out Gypsy for criticism by saying there's only one tune on the album that doesn't live up to the billing, and that one is Gypsy. It's the least inspired and has by far the weakest vocal line and guitar playing. After the one...
Okay, who said that?
Nick's Metal Blog.
They're shit.
That answers my question. I was going to say, is this harsh criticism? I guess he would fully agree that it is.
No, it's rubbish criticism.
Yeah.
It's not harsh, it's rubbish.
Yeah.
Because it's not true at all. That is absolute rubbish. How dare they say that? I hope they're not drinking in my local pub. Start an argument about that, mate.
Yeah.
Well, I've got to say, I mean, it's fun to drop this criticism in every now and again, but I wouldn't say I agree with it by any stretch. We'll move on to Caught in the Middle. This one was written, according to Ronnie, about engineer Angelo Arcuri. He says Angelo's life always seemed to be that of one caught in the middle of some kind of turmoil. He would always make decisions that were wrong, and he would always come to me and go, Ron, what am I going to do? I feel that this song's a great example of how Dio can take a real-life situation like that and still add that really mystical, fantastical vibe. And I think he does that really great here on Caught in the Middle.
Yeah, I think for many of us, then it does seem like a leap, but things that happen in your own life and happen to the people around you, you do end up using as inspiration and maybe is a couple of steps removed from that original situation, and maybe sometimes it's not and it's exactly what it says on the tin. But yeah, I feel that is, you never know where these ideas are going to come from. You never know what group of words will produce a melody that is interesting just by saying those words. It is very interesting to think that idea has come from a personal situation and then transformed that into something with a very deep meaning.
Yeah. I mean, if we move on to Don't Talk to Strangers, in the interview included with the 2005 remaster, Dio reveals Don't Talk to Strangers is the second song he wrote for the album before the band came together, and he calls the song a product of his guitar playing. We don't often talk about Dio as a guitar player, particularly when he's in bands with people like Tony Iommi, Richie Blackmore, Vivian Campbell. We also know that Dio initially jammed playing bass with Vinnie Appice in the beginnings of this album. Do you think that he's underrated as a multi-instrumentalist? We talk so much about him as a vocalist, but it seems that he is very talented in many, many aspects of music.
Well, I think it's a communication tool in the end. You know, one of the reasons that when I spoke to Bruce Dickinson about this, one of the reasons he learnt to play guitar was quite simply to be able to communicate his musical ideas better. And for me, I play keyboards very, very badly, but I have written a couple of songs on the keyboard and I have written a couple of songs on acoustic guitar. I am no guitar player at all. I wouldn't, you know, I work with the most incredible, talented guitar players and instrumentalists. But it is sometimes there is this feeling of frustration that you can't get your idea over. And there's sometimes that you really need to work alone and you need to pursue something with no one else's input. You have to find this gold in the mountain. You've got to find where is that deep vein of gold? Where is the heart and soul of this idea? Where is it hidden? And you really don't want anybody along with you on that part of the journey. When you've got the gold, it's nice to bring it out of the mine, bring it to the world and say, guys, I've got some gold. Now let's get it polished up and make something out of it. But sometimes to get that initial idea, you just do whatever you can. And I think that's why that Ronnie played those things, you know, and was able to do that and play those instruments for the same reason as many of us do. It's a communication thing. You've got to get over to the band. The exact and precise nature of the idea, no, it goes like this. And you've got this whole idea in your head from start to finish. You have everything in place, but it's in your head. And you have to find a way to get that out of your head and into the room and into the other people's heads to eventually feel it all come together. That's difficult, but that's what you have to do to if you want to do something that is absolutely classic and magical and immortal.
Yeah. And I mean, Dio talking about kind of his guitar playing, he says, I think a lot of the things I've written, riffs and song that I've written on my own, are more acceptable because I play like every man. So it's perhaps this like every man approach to riffs that make an album like Holy Diver more accessible, even when its subject matter might be daunting for some, but then kind of with the riffs and the music make it that much easier.
Nobody has to like it.
Yeah.
You know, this is the wonderful, wonderful thing about music that many people forget is there's so many different kinds of music out there. Mm-hmm. You don't have to like everything. You just don't have to. It's okay not to like Ronnie James Dio. It's okay not to like Holy Diver. And, you know, because you like Sheena Easton or, you know, you like Sia or somebody else, you know, some other contemporary pop artist. You prefer Justin Timberlake to Ronnie James Dio and his work. That's okay. It's just okay. You don't have to like everything that somebody does. But it's so rewarding when you find an artist that really speaks to you. Someone that almost no matter what they do, you put that album on and it says something to you. And the great albums, even after 20 and 30 plays, they still keep talking to you and you're still connected to them. But that's an individual experience between the listener and the album and the composer. So it's okay that, you know, not that people don't think everything is great or they only like one song. It's all, that is okay. But to really be rewarded by music is to really investigate and learn about the album and listen to it in the order that the artist wanted you to listen to those songs in. And that's something very special. And if you can do that and you have the time and it's possible to do that, that is when the album reveals itself in a new and complete way that it just won't if you only pick odd songs out here and there.
Yeah,
absolutely. So let's get on to Straight Through the Heart. So a review at metalarchives.com singles out Vinnie Appice's performance on this one. The smashing drum intro by Appice gives you the first punch in the stomach before Dio unleashes some streaming rock energy. Given that Vinnie jammed with Ronnie in the very early stages of these songs, you could say that his DNA is all over these tracks just as much as Ronnie's is.
Yeah, I think so. It's got to be a case of, hey, I've got this little bit of a lick. Why don't we try this for an intro? Because, you know, one of the harder parts or the most frustrating parts is, well, how do we start it? If you've got the body of the song and you have this wonderful chorus, well, how are we going to start it so that people notice it? And how do we make it that song not just unique for the song on the album, but how do we really try and make it a unique intro against all rock songs? And it's an incredible challenge. Perhaps it was some kind of borderline arrogance that they said, hey, I think people will notice this.
Yeah, and I mean, Ronnie said in interviews that drum sound that we've been talking about throughout our chat, it comes from they encased Vinnie in like a makeshift room made of plywood, which they then mic'd up. It made the drums so alive, just like the rest of the tracks were, is the quote I've got here. And that reminds me of the effort that Kiss put into getting that drum sound on Creatures of the Night, kind of the hard work to get to something that sounds different and fresh. And obviously, I mean, you said yourself the influence that Vinnie's drumming has had on your own material.
Well, we're also victims of fashion. Someone will do something a little bit different and the album will become a success and then people will go, I want the drum sound from that album. And sometimes, for me, that's not a very good sound of a drum. But some people want something very processed or they want something with a snare drum that's tuned, a thin snare tuned very high to poke out and a different kind of bass drum sound and all of that. So we're victims many times of the fashion and what is successful and the drum sounds in the charts at that time and technology. People want to, a new technology comes along and produces a certain kind of reverb or something like this, and people want to use it on their album. We're victims in that way. And one of the things that you could say about Holy Diver is what you are getting is something that is natural, something that is raw and natural, but played incredibly well from the heart. It's a well-tuned, well-miked kit played by a devil, a demon. Yeah. And that's just a wonderful, wonderful thing. It's not fashionable. It's not trying to be anything except a well-tuned kit in the style that he wants it to be, tuned the way he wants it tuned, that represents him as a drummer. Not, right, what's the most popular drum sound? What will make us stand out on radio? And that's a rare and a lovely, lovely thing to hear someone as themselves, to hear the man play the drum, the man moving the air. It's elemental. You are striking something and moving air, and you are catching that in a microphone, and you are turning that into magnetism, and you are rearranging things, tiny particles on a tape, all from striking that drum with that stick. And to get that to mean something is incredible. So as much as in heavy metal we have been victims of fashion over the years, there are also some people who go, no, that's not how I sound. And they just stick to it, and it's fantastic.
And I've got a great quote from Vinnie about our next track, which is Invisible. It's just a great story of how it kind of came to be. Vinnie says that we came in, we smoked a whole bunch of pot, and our sound man put the tape in backwards. It started playing and we all sat there laughing, going, you asshole. But then we started saying, wait a minute, that sounds good. So we wound up learning the riff backwards, and that's the other part of Invisible. It's the riff forwards and then backwards. And it just shows you we were talking about kind of happenstance and things happening by accident and chance, and there's another great example.
Yeah, it does. I think that's the magic, really, that these accidents happen and you can embrace them and not go, well, don't be stupid. You can go, you can listen to it and go, well, actually, does it make sense? Is this an accident that is something we're pleased about? Not all accidents are bad. And it's nice. And it's happened to me many times where got confused, done the wrong thing, and it's actually fitted by mistake. And I didn't mean to use that lyric on that song. And by some fluke, it's worked in that riff, in that situation. And if you'd started from scratch and tried to put something together, it just wouldn't have worked. But by accident, with the wrong riff in the wrong place, it worked. And on my Silicon Messiah album, Silicon Messiah, the song, something similar happened on there. I was singing the chorus over the wrong part, and everybody's looking at me, and I'm going, what are you looking at? And I say, well, that's not the chorus. I'll go, well, it is that. and that's what happened, and it changes. So it was just an accident, you know. It was the pure arrogance of going, I'm right, even though I'm completely wrong. I'm going to say I'm right because it actually sounds good. So these things happen, and it's great, I think, when you can follow that. And it turns out good. It's a wonderful, rewarding feeling.
Yeah, yeah. And so we'll move on to our next track, possibly one of the most well-known on the album, Rainbow in the Dark. So the guitar riff came from a Sweet Savage song called Lady Mary Ann. And Vivian Campbell told Classic Rock magazine, we played it for Ronnie, and he immediately started singing the melody on top of it. And then Jimmy went over to this little Yamaha and came up with the keyboard motif. We had the song written in 10 minutes. What do you think it is about that kind of little keyboard riff of sorts that's become so iconic?
Yeah, I don't know. It's magic, isn't it? It's just pure magic. It's It's the same as Black Knight with Deep Purple. That's another famous 10-minute song in the writing. That's why another song done in the pub, you know. So I don't know. There's just something about the phrasing of that and the tempo of it as well. It's just something about that tempo, that phrasing, that brings it to life. It's some unusual announcement. And for me, when I first listened to the album, I absolutely didn't expect that at all. For me, it was one of the more challenging songs on the album because it was a lot different. And, you know, you have to trust that they did it with the best intention and, you know, they did it because they felt like it and they followed their feelings. And it's something that I don't question at all now. I revel in it now.
And I think it's interesting with you saying it was one of the more challenging tracks for you, that Dio actually, he hated the song upon completion. And I've got a quote here that said, "When it was finished, I announced to everyone that I had a razor blade and I was just going to cut the tape. And he needed people to talk him out of that. He thought the song was too poppy, and he stood by that for a long time after." Do you think it comes across as a poppy track?
Yeah, but that's not a bad thing.
No.
No, it's a risk that sometimes if you want to invite this darkness and play in the shadows and invite people to come with you to the shadows, that a moment of light may disrupt the way they feel and they're going to forget about the intensity of the emotion in those shadows. But a great album, a truly great album, lives for 100 plays. And so, whatever you don't like that first time, if it has heart, if it has passion, eventually it will find you and it will capture you and it will make you sing it in the shower. And you will go, "What the bloody hell am I singing? Oh no, it's Rainbow in the Dark." And then years later, anytime you hear it, it will produce a sense of fondness and nostalgia that if you were hungry, you could probably eat.
And I've got, just before we move on, obviously Dio has a quote here about rainbows. Obviously rainbows were something, kind of a motif that went through a lot of his music. And he said, "A rainbow is a natural phenomenon that is so awesome and so seldom seen that it never fails to draw a response from us all. Rainbows have always made me realise how insignificant we can be in the grand scheme of things." And I just think that's a really beautiful way to kind of describe a rainbow. And it adds a bit more kind of context to the song for me as well.
Yeah, I think we all have these things that we visit. And for me, I've never, ever had a problem with Ronnie James Dio visiting the idea of rainbows at all. Like, never, you know, it's a motif. It comes back and the darkness comes back again and again. For me, that's fine. You know, it's something that meant something to him. And so it is something that represents real feeling to me. So for me, it's great. In my own work, then identity is a very important thing. And I often ask the question, who am I? And what is your identity? And many of my songs come back to this theme. And sometimes when I think, oh, should I be writing about this again? And then I just think about Ronnie. And I think, well, hang on. Ronnie wrote that these subjects that were important to him were recurring, and I never had a problem with it, and I often enjoyed it. So I take that as some kind of solace, really, that, well, you've got to follow your heart and you've got to follow your gut if this is what you're thinking about and what you need to express right now, then that's what you have to do. So I think it is a beautiful sentiment and another one of those juxtapositions and paradoxes that he gets us with a rainbow in the dark. It's impossible in physics to have a rainbow in the dark. But of course, spiritually and emotionally, it is completely and utterly possible. And it's a reality that we do have a rainbow in the dark because we are actually clinging to the dream of something pure and perfect and untouchable.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we'll move on to our final track, Shame on the Night. So I've got a quote from Ronnie, just kind of what this song is about. He says, "Nighttime is the worst time of the day to have problems. Everything during the day seems like life is going to be okay, but as soon as it gets dark and dreary, you start thinking too much. There's not much you can do at 4 o'clock in the morning but think." And I think that this is kind of part of the appeal of his songwriting, that we've got all these kind of wonderful motifs and fantasy elements going on, but there's a very human and emotional core to everything he writes. And I feel that that is really kind of, Shame on the Night is a really good example of that.
Yeah, and it is so true, really, that out there on the road, it's difficult to sleep. Many, many times, you're on long journeys, you're working in the evenings, and it's difficult sometimes to let that adrenaline go from a good show. And when things don't go so well and you start to question yourself, there is really nothing that you can do about it until that next show where you can try and put things right. And there's no way to make that night shorter. And all we have are the obvious socially acceptable sedatives that we use. We can have the TV on, we can play video games, we can drink alcohol and take pills and do all kinds of drugs to block these things out. But at night, that is when the demons really come.
How does Shame on the Night close the album for you? Do you think it's kind of in a good place on the album?
Well, I think it's bold, really, because you're not leaving the album on a high. You know, and it's a decision that you have to make when you're putting tracks together and you're looking at the way that things nestle up to each other. And in those days, you're thinking in side one and side two. What closes side one, what closes side two and finishes the album? What are you going to leave people with? And I think it's very bold, really, to leave us with Shame on the Night instead of Straight Through the Heart, which would, you could say, would be a more positive album closer, or Invisible, or Caught in the Middle. You could say, we could leave the album on a high, but no, we don't. We leave the album in the shadows. We leave the album in the land that Ronnie visits so often, where voodoo is real, where magic is real, where the shadows come to life and loom large behind us and affect us. So I think it's very bold to leave the album with this song. Now, the other thing that it does is, it kind of leaves a pause there, which I'm ready to hear, then stand up and shout. Really, it's made me start and want to play the album again and get back to the excitement. But I can't leave. I can't deny that. I can't deny this darkness is real.
So just to kind of, as we start to sum up, I mean, obviously we've covered so much ground on this album. Vivian Campbell told Classic Rock magazine, "Ronnie was a grafter. I found him intimidating. And no, I still don't feel we got a fair shake of the stick when it came to the money or later the music. But he was a fantastic fucking singer. And Holy Diver is still a fantastic fucking album. and I'm proud to say I helped make it with him. We all are. With that in mind, how does this album stand the test of time with you?
Well, you know, one of the things is sadly, and I think this is true of many classic albums, is it, well, sadly for the people involved, it lives beyond them. It is its own thing. It is a classic album. And it doesn't matter if you don't know the band. It doesn't matter if you don't know the names of the guys in the band. It doesn't matter if you don't know the name of the singer. If you listen to the album from start to finish, it is classic. And if you listen to it two or three times, you're not going to live your life without this album as part of your collection, if you're a music lover, or rock music lover anyway. So that's the tragedy and the joy, the bitterness and the sweetness, I think, of being involved in a classic album. And I would love one of my albums to be considered classic in the future. I would absolutely love that. But the sadness of it is it's beyond you. It's beyond you. It doesn't matter that you were involved in it. It's a classic album. It lives on its own now. Something made that album live and have its own life and mean something as a collection of songs, as music and lyrics that fit together, these ideas that fit together. They live their own life now. So it doesn't matter what we say about it. We can rejoice and we can be happy that we know this album. And I certainly revel in this album. Now I have my own very small, modest recording studio. And occasionally I can go and listen to this classic album on studio quality speakers and hear more details than I ever did when I was 18 years old, working in that hotel on that night shift, listening to a little 5-watt cassette speaker, listening to the dodgy headphones of my father on his hi-fi. I can hear more details and more of that now, and it still means something. But it is its own thing. It has an identity of its own, away from the people that created it. And that is the joy and the sadness of the classic album, in my opinion, as a writer.
And finally, and it's our final question on the album, why is Holy Diver your classic album, and why should people check it out if they haven't already?
Well, for me, it's my classic album because it's of the time. It's of a time. It deeply affected me at a time in my life where I was looking for direction, and I meet so many of my fans that tell me the stories about how they got into my Silicon Messiah album, or how they listened to me for the first time with Iron Maiden, and X Factor meant so much to them, or Virtual 11 meant so much to them, or my Silicon Messiah album and my new trilogy, that, and people quote lyrics at me. So I think it's important to me of its time at that point, that where I was in my life, I found that album and it meant a lot to me. And so that's why it's classic in one respect. In another way, it's classic of its time, but it's relevant now because, in one way, nothing has changed. There is a metal guitar, there are big drums and drum fills, and there are these rumbling bass lines, and there is a soaring vocal. All of those elements are totally available today in music, and many bands are using those elements in ways that aren't that different to what Ronnie James Dio and his band did when they did Holy Diver. So in some ways, nothing has changed. If you listen without prejudice to Holy Diver, and you've never heard it before, and you know Disturbed, and you know Sabaton, and you know Iron Maiden, and you know Udo Dirk Snider, then I think you give that a couple of spins, you're going to go, wow, actually, I can see the connection between all of these things. And this is something that I get a feeling from. But that's only my opinion. That's why you should listen to it. It's one of those things that I think in the rite of passage of certain albums that we all should listen to on the journey to find the artists that we truly love, then Holy Diver has to be one of those albums that we should all hear once.
Well, Blaise, thank you very much for taking the time out to chat with me about Holy Diver. And obviously, I know you've got so much going on next year. And thank you very much for taking time out of a very busy schedule to chat with me about what is a truly classic album.
Okay, well, thank you. And good luck with your show.
So that was Blaise Bailey talking with me about the fantastic Holy Diver by Dio. Now, you know what it is? I actually recorded that interview a few months ago. And the thing with Blaise Bailey is he's like ridiculously busy all the time. So, you know, the stuff that he was talking to me about that he was up to, you know, has kind of since passed. But, you know, he released two albums last year. The Redemption of William Black, Infinite Entanglement Part 3. And a classical acoustic album called December Wind. And it seems like the guy is constantly on tour. So as we speak, he's in Latin America, but he is on a European tour, which kicks off on the 1st of March and has extensive UK dates throughout late March right into April. And all of the dates for the tour and all the information on both fantastic albums and indeed anything about Blaise Bailey is over at blaisebailey.net. And, you know, what an awesome dude. Like, I was sitting there listening to him and I was like, yeah, I like this guy. He's awesome. Haven't got enough good things to say about him. And also, I mean, what he also said to me is, if you go and see Blaise Bailey, so if you buy a ticket for his UK tour, he insists that his meet and greet is free. So if you want to meet the man and you want to talk to him about Ronnie James Dio, I'm sure he'll be more than happy to engage you in that conversation and just get yourself to the meet and greet because it's free. You know, some bands charge hundreds of pounds for that kind of thing. And Blaise is just happy to hang out before or after the show and just chill out. So absolutely, get yourself to blaisebailey.net for those tour dates and for more information on both those albums and indeed his entire discography. And that'll do it for another episode of My Classic Album. But as I said, over the next few months, we have many more awesome episodes still to come. So make sure you join me next month for another episode of My Classic Album. See you then. Cheers.